This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest Reza Aslan counts himself among the Muslims who want to reconcile their religious values with the realities of the modern world, as opposed to those who react to modernism and reform by reverting, sometimes fanatically, to the, quote, fundamentals of their faith. Aslan has written a new book called No God But God, The Origins, Evolution, and Future of Islam. He's taught Islamic and Middle Eastern studies at the University of Iowa, where he also received an MFA in fiction from the Writers' Workshop. He's studied religion at Santa Clara University, Harvard, and the University of California, Santa Barbara. He was born in Iran and fled the country as a child with his parents, shortly after the Ayatollah Khomeini came to power. Many Americans consider Islam to be distant from Judaism and Christianity, but Aslan writes about how interconnected the three religions are.
Judaism, Christianity, and Islam share a single sacred history. They are, I call them, branches of the same Abrahamic tree. And Islam is firmly rooted in the values and myths and traditions of the Bible. In fact, almost every single biblical prophet is mentioned in the Quran, including Jesus. Most of the sort of the basic outline of the gospel narrative is recounted in the Quran. And Muhammad himself, this is something that I think is really interesting, never claimed to be preaching a new religion. On the contrary, I mean, he very clearly considered his prophetic mission to bring the God of the Jews and the Christians to the Arab peoples. There's a verse in the Quran that says, God has established for the Arabs the same religion that he enjoined on Noah and on Abraham and on Moses and on Jesus. So this is a continuation, as far as Muhammad was concerned, of that biblical prophetic tradition.
Did he consider the Jews and the Christians to have the same God?
Absolutely. There's no question about that whatsoever. He considered his mission to be to bring the God of the Jews and the Christians to the pagan Arab tribes of his community. In fact, the Jews and the Christians throughout the Quran are considered people of the book. And the Quran was specifically meant to bring a version of that book, an interpretation of that book, to the Arab people who did not have anything like that, who did not have anything resembling a revealed religion.
A lot of Westerners think of Islam as a culture that keeps women subservient and shrouded in a veil. You write that Muhammad gave rights and privileges to women that they never had before. What were some of those rights?
Muhammad was, more than anything else, a social reformer. He called for radical social and financial and even political reform in the Mecca that he grew up in and that he preached in. His community, the community that he established eventually, that became sort of the foundation of the Muslim community, that community gave certain egalitarian rights to all members, not just women, but also to orphans and widows and the poor and slaves who were all freed, the dispossessed. It was an egalitarian community. And with regard to women especially, I mean, Muhammad gave women the right to both inherit the property of their husbands, to keep their dowries as their own personal property throughout their marriage. He forbade a husband to touch his wife's dowry. He both limited how many wives a man could marry. In pre-Islamic Arabia, a man could marry as many wives as he wanted to. Wives were considered property. And he also gave women the right to divorce their husbands. Now, perhaps in our modern sensibilities, these seem like very small things, but the fact is that they were absolutely revolutionary at the time, and they caused an enormous amount of social disruption. And, you know, as I say in the book, that's primarily why, not long after Muhammad's death, most of these egalitarian reforms were gradually reversed.
Yeah, so why is it that it is Islam now that is the culture in which women are behind the veil? Mm-hmm. And why is it that so many Muslim leaders turn to their faith to explain and justify that?
Right. Well, I think, first of all, I need to say that the Quran, like all holy scriptures, was deeply affected by the cultural norms of the society in which it was revealed. I mean, this was a society that did not consider women to be equal members of the tribe. And so as a result, there are numerous verses in the Quran that along with the Jewish and Christian scriptures, clearly reflect the subordinate position that women had in the male-dominated societies of the ancient world. However, a lot of what we now sort of see as these emblems of Islamic subjugation of women, and the veil in particular, are more the result of cultural and local practices. I'll give you a perfect example. The veil, I think, is a great example. I think it would come as a surprise for a lot of people to learn that nowhere in the whole of the Quran is the veil in any way enjoined on women, except for the wives of Muhammad himself. The veil was a cultural practice that Muslims borrowed from the upper class women in Syria and Iran. And it was a way of sort of separating those women within the Muslim community who were separate, who were distinct from the rest of the women. And it's precisely for this reason that during Muhammad's lifetime, no other woman in the Muslim community except for Muhammad's wives took on the veil. It was only after Muhammad's death that women started to voluntarily adopt wearing the veil as a means of emulating the prophet's wives.
Making it sound that like a lot of women first took on the veil because it's what the celebrities did, you know, like the wives of Muhammad. Well, do you know what I mean? It was like a status,
correct.
Like it was a status symbol.
Absolutely. I mean, we have to remember that at this day and age, a woman who didn't have to work in the fields could remain veiled and secluded from the rest of the community. And so it was absolutely a sign of social status and a sign of the inviability. And, you know, it came to be seen as a distinctive emblem. I get asked this question about the veil a lot, and I can sit here and tell you what the correct interpretation of the Quran is, and what the Quran actually says about the veil, and what the historical practice of the veil was, and what the meaning of the veil was. But the problem is that I'm speaking from a position of a man who's never worn the veil. This is what I think is so important about this discussion, is that it is up to Muslim women to decide for themselves whether they want to wear the veil or not. It is not up to Muslim men to decide. It is not up to scholars like myself to decide. And it is not up to governments to decide. This is a choice that women must be allowed to make themselves.
I understand what you mean. I would just ask you this. What about the fact that there are some women who live in remote places who are only told that they should wear the veil, that
yes,
it's a part of the faith that they wear the veil. They don't know that there are other options. They've never heard another interpretation of it. So, you know, if you only hear one thing and that one thing mandates the veil and tells you that it's a good thing for whatever reasons, then it would be more difficult for you to either come up with another interpretation or feel justified in believing it.
You're absolutely right. And of course, the key to freedom, the key to liberty is always education. It's always knowledge. And that's what my hope is with this book. And I think that there are a number of people like myself throughout the Muslim world who are desperately struggling to provide an ideological counter argument, an ideological counterweight to these traditionalists, one can say fundamentalist viewpoints that permeate throughout the Muslim world.
You were born in Iran and lived there for the first 7 years of your life. How religious was your home? Like, what was your parents' approach in bringing you up in an Islamic home?
You know, Iranians are no different than peoples of most countries. You know, if you're born in Iran, you're pretty much a Muslim, just like a great number of Americans just sort of naturally call themselves Christian. It's not any more or less religious. In fact, I would argue that it's less religious than the United States. So I grew up in your basic average Muslim family. You know, we went to mosque occasionally and you know, we celebrated the Muslim holidays and we celebrated the Iranian national holidays. My mom was a spiritual person. My father is, well, I could most politely refer to him as anti-religious. He is someone who really sees and has an enormous amount of bitterness, as a great many Iranians in the United States do, over what has happened to Iran and the clerical control that has really stifled the freedom and the independence and the reform that was taking place in Iran. He really blames Islam for that rather than the clerics themselves. And I think a lot of people agree with him.
What were your parents? You were very young. So what were your parents' expectations when the Shah was overthrown and Khomeini came to power?
Well, I think most everyone in Iran thought that this was going to be a wonderful thing. Only after the Shah left and only after the revolution sort of was completed, came to fruition, did Iran then become the Islamic republic that it is now. But for most of us, I mean, this was an opportunity to get those freedoms and those liberties that we were fighting for in the first place, that we were promised throughout the revolution in the first place. And there's been an enormous amount of disappointment by the very same people who led this revolution, who are now feeling as though that their original intentions had been betrayed.
So what was the turning point for your parents at which they realized that this wasn't going to be a democratizing revolution, that one form of tyranny, the Shah, was going to be replaced with another form of tyranny, the Ayatollah?
It was the creation of the Constitution. When the Constitution was drafted and it became very clear that this Constitution was going to lead the way towards the clerical domination of the country, that's when my father realized it's time to leave. And we got out of Iran at the last minute, right before the country closed.
How did your parents explain to you that you were going to flee the country?
Well, as far as I remember it, they just woke me up one morning and said, "Get your stuff." That's really how I remember it. It was a spur of the moment decision. I think we were in a rush to get out before the borders were sealed, and we just sort of got on the first flight out. We left most of our possessions behind and ended up, as so many Iranians did, in London, and then from London came to the United States.
When your parents said, "Get your stuff," what did you take?
Well, I mean, we were each allowed one suitcase. But then by the time we got to the airport and we saw the millions and millions of other people trying to get out and the absolute chaos that was taking place at customs, we knew that it would be a miracle even if we could take that one suitcase along. In fact, most of our valuables had to be left behind with the customs agents, who basically opened our suitcase and found the things that they wanted and said, "You can't take this," and pocketed it themselves.
You describe in your book that your mother at the airport hollered at you, "Hold on to your sister." And she was afraid in this crush of people that if you let go of your sister, you might not all make it together. You might not get
That's
on
right.
the plane together. What a really frightening thing for a 7-year-old to have to deal with. What was that moment like for you when you realized you had to hold on tight?
It was like a dream. The entire thing was really like a dream. I mean, I just remember grasping onto my sister and kicking at the people in front of me and knocking people to the ground as a 7-year-old boy dragging his 4-year-old sister behind him, making sure that I never lost sight of my mother. But I really did feel, I really did have the sense that if something happened, if I let go of my sister or if I lost sight of my mother, that would be the end of it, that we would be separated forever.
So you went first to London, and then how soon after that did you move to the U.S.?
Quite soon after that, about a few months afterwards, we moved to the U.S. We moved to Oklahoma, which is the only place my father had ever been in the United States. I think it's what he thought the United States was. We went to Enid, Oklahoma.
And, it seems like a very improbable place.
It is. It's as you can imagine, first time I'd ever seen snow. I was really confused. And during that first year, we really didn't have anything with us, so we had to live in a one-room motel. And of course, my father told the management that he had no kids, so my sister and I were never allowed to actually leave the hotel during the daylight hours. So we just sat in a hotel and watched TV for 24 hours a day for about a year. And at the end of the year, both of us were absolutely fluent in English. So it ended up working okay.
Well, you know, your parents basically had to flee Iran because of the tyranny there. So successful. The family gets out in one piece, all intact. And what luck, you move to Oklahoma, and now you're not allowed to leave the motel room, and no one's allowed to know that you're there. So basically you're a prisoner in a cheap hotel room, and right. It's not exactly fleeing to freedom for you during that first year.
No, it's not. And it was an incredibly difficult time for my family and caused an enormous amount of tension. You know, for a 7-year-old and a 4-year-old, you figure out a way to have your own fun. And quite frankly, seeing television for the like this, I mean, we had TV in Iran, but not 24 hours and not 30 channels and not Chips and Sesame Street. And, you know, for a while, I mean, this is how I learned about not just how to speak English, but about American culture is watching, you know, Ponch and John riding down the L.A. freeways and blowing up cars for no reason. I thought for a long time, I thought cars just all the time flipped over as they were driving around freeways. I thought that was a perfectly normal thing for them to do in America.
What kind of work did your parents do in Iran?
Well, they really didn't work. You know, I sometimes like to say that it's the people like my parents that the revolution was originally intended against. My father comes from a very large landed aristocracy, a landed old tribal family. And my mother is the child of entertainers. My grandfather, Jahangir, and my grandmother, Giti, were both quite famous stage and television actors in Iran. So my mom came from this liberal, modern Iranian, sort of the new Iran, and my father came from the ancient tribal old Iran. So it was really a clash of civilizations right there that gave birth to me.
The United States and Europe has been trying to figure out what its policy should be now toward Iran and Iran's move toward being a nuclear power. So can you talk a little bit about watching that play out?
Right. Well, I've been writing and lecturing and teaching about the U.S. taking a far more active role in engaging Iran in the nuclear diplomacy the way that the Europeans have for, I don't know how long now, for years. And I'm really glad that the Bush administration has finally decided to do so, to take a more active part in negotiations. I mean, the fact is that we cannot allow this particular regime in Iran to become a nuclear weapons regime. I think that there's very little indication that they would do so, but you know, it's really hard to trust what this regime says, whether they truly want to have these nuclear weapons and whether it's just for civilian purposes, as they say. But I think it's important that the world body recognizes that Iran is not a hermit kingdom like North Korea. It is not a oppressive theocracy like Saudi Arabia is. It is quite an open society, and it is a society that can be engaged in negotiation. It is a society that can be engaged in dialogue, and it is a society that has the vast majority of its population who desperately wants the country to be opened, to be more open to the West economically, socially, and the only way to do so is through negotiations, not through sanctions, and certainly not through isolations. That hasn't worked.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
It was absolutely my pleasure.
Reza Aslan is the author of No God But God, The Origins, Evolution, and Future of Islam.